1979, Alien. Is this a slasher movie in space or a haunted house movie in space or a little bit of both?
Well, Ridley Scott said that he was very influenced by Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think I've read that he insisted that everybody watch that movie before he did, before they started production on Alien. So to the extent that we consider Texas Chainsaw Massacre a slasher movie, and I guess Alien is as well. But he also said he was very influenced by 2001 and by Star Wars, surprisingly. And it's very,
right, for the space stuff.
He said some very nice things about the first Star Wars movie. He called it formidable.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice thing for a guy like him to say. He also referred to it as an old dark house movie in outer space, which is very much in keeping with some of the stuff that we've been talking about over the past number of episodes. And you can see that, too. I mean, it really does feel like a mansion or a castle that they're all creeping around. Those scenes that when... Harry Dean Stanton is walking through those chambers looking for the cat, and there's like chains hanging from the and water dripping from above. It's all almost like he's walking through a dungeon, or you know, almost like a torture chamber.
Yeah.
So that would be in keeping with the sort of gothic roots of the old dark house genre.
Yeah.
So it is kind of a slasher movie in the sense that, like a body count movie, it's one person being picked off after the other by some unseen force, which is, you know, similar to the premise that they have in a lot of old dark house movies, and also in the giallo body count type movies that Dario Argento and people like that would do. But it also... one of the things that I feel very is very strong in it, and I don't know if this is because Dan O'Bannon or Ridley Scott were particularly interested in H.P. Lovecraft. H.R. Giger might have been.
Oh, yeah.
This is very much a Lovecraftian story. The world and the environment that it creates is very Lovecraftian. As a matter of fact, I haven't read this in years. This is my copy of At the Mountains of Madness, which is one of Lovecraft's most famous books. And I realized in looking over the synopsis today, the plot, it's very similar in a way to Alien. And also the approach that Ridley Scott took in keeping so much of it unseen, right? A lot of shadow, a lot of smoke, obscuring our vision of what's going on, a lot of rapid cutting in some of the action scenes, so we can't quite tell what we're looking at. That's sort of in keeping with Lovecraft's approach. People always speak about how Lovecraft was always trying to get around describing the phenomenon in specific detail. He would use sort of descriptive terms like ghastly, horrible, or, you know, things like that. But you never really knew exactly what he was talking about, you know. And it reminded me of this quote that I'll read from Lovecraft. This was in the book that he wrote about supernatural horror and literature. He wrote a little book about his philosophy of how to write cosmic horror stories. And he says, the basis of all true cosmic horror is the violation of the order of nature, which you see in Alien. It's not a violation of the cosmic order of nature. It's a violation of our understanding of nature,
right?
We're encountering something that's completely different from our experience. But he says, the basis of all true cosmic horror is the violation of the order of nature, and the profoundest violations are always the least concrete and describable. So what he's saying there sort of leads into what Ridley Scott's approach was, that the most horrifying things are the things that are almost impossible to describe in concrete terms. And for a filmmaker, probably best to avoid describing in concrete terms, avoiding giving us all the details about what the space jockey is and what exactly they were up to with all those eggs in his ship. And the whole history of his species and all that sort of stuff. We don't know, right?
Yeah, you save that to your later movie you make, well, 20 years later.
Unfortunately, that's what's happened.
Yeah.
But I think that we are afraid of things that we don't understand.
Right?
The unknown is, and this is another thing that Lovecraft was always on about, the unknown is the thing that we fear the most. And as soon as you begin to add all sorts of detail, as soon as you begin to give us the backstory on everything, then we become familiar with it, and it's no longer has the power to scare us. When I first saw Alien in 1979, I saw it at the New York Twin Theater. I think it was up on 62nd Street. It's still there, the theater, which is unusual. Most of the theaters are long gone. But I saw it in a packed house. And nobody in the theater had any idea what to expect. And when I sat down in the theater, you know me, I'm always buying the program.
Got your program.
I got the program. And right away, I was really encouraged by looking at the photos because, again, I didn't know anything about what to expect about the film. I knew it was something about space travel. But as soon as I start looking at these photos, and you see things like the photo of the space jockey, somebody who's coming into this movie, they don't know what it's about. They see this, they're thinking, this is going to be something, right?
Yeah.
We had never seen anything like that in the movie before. And we had never seen anything like the designs that H.R. Giger came up with before. So it was an extraordinarily effective movie for the crowd that I saw it with. The audience was just absolutely, you know, on the edge of their seat. And I think it was largely due to the fact that we had no idea what to expect, the fear of the unknown.
Right.
We went in not knowing what the plot was beyond just a basic premise, and we had no idea what we were going to be subjected to. And the movie can be really seen now as a suspense movie with like three major shock scenes. It probably is not as effective for modern audiences. And it's probably not really as effective for us, having seen it. I mean, I must have seen it 30 times in my life, because movies that rely entirely on suspense and, you know, with occasional surprises or shocks, they're not going to be as effective in, you know, repeated watchings. In the same way, those old Dark House movies usually aren't as effective afterwards if you've seen them several times, because you know all the surprises, right? You know all the shocks that are coming up. In Alien's case, you have the first big shock, I guess, of course, would be the classic scene of John Hurt, you know, giving birth, as he says, his birthing scene. The chest burster scene is really just everybody was stunned by that.
Yeah.
And the second big shock, I guess, is when Ian Holmes' character, the robot, and he's actually described as a robot in the movie, he tries to kill Sigourney Weaver, and then he gets his head knocked off.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, when I was watching that the first time, I thought, this movie's going off the rails. What the fuck is going on? Yeah. First, he's got like what looks like milk dripping down his face. And my mind is thinking, is that just supposed to be sweat? And they sort of put a little color in it to make it stand out in the photography. But then he's got, you know, it's like streaming off. And then he's trying to kill her by stuffing a rolled up porno magazine down his throat. And when Yaphet Kotto finally comes in and gives him a bash and his head goes flying off, I said, I don't know what the fuck this is.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing and it was startling, but for a moment there, I thought they had just lost control of their senses. You know, I thought the filmmaker had just gone crazy. and that's and the final shock scene, I guess, is when the alien ends up in the shuttlecraft. You know, we think the movie's over.
Yeah.
And of course, the more savvy people in the audience are thinking, well, if it was over, then it would be over.
Right?
Over,
yeah.
There's a reason why the movie is still going on, and it's probably because the alien is going to make another appearance. But the way he makes the appearance, after she's taken off her clothes and she's basically completely vulnerable, right? She's down to her panties, and suddenly that arm shoots out.
Comes out, yeah.
And you've been trained by the movie up to that point to be very concerned about little gray, shiny objects.
Yeah.
And you're thinking when she reaches into some of the stuff and you see that big bulbous head in the foreground, you're thinking, geez, could that be the alien? Oh, you know, is it possible that that's the alien? And of course, it turns out that the alien is there. And,
yeah.
So that was a big shock. And the rest of the movie really is intentionally slow because they're constantly trying to build the suspense, right? I guess if you wanted to throw in the other big shock in the film to make it a four, you could say the other big shock is the first time the alien kills somebody when it gets Harry Dean Stanton. And
I was going to say, watching it again today, Tom Skerritt climbing through the corridor.
Oh, yeah.
And the first time you see the alien with his hands coming out today, that's, I mean, that was still, that whole scene still tense and causes complete anxiety when I was watching it.
Well, those scenes when I saw it,
and I was wondering if maybe that's where they got the idea for the scenes in Die Hard of climbing through the.
Well, possibly.
That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, yet it's never quite clear how a movie that's as influential as this, what other things it might influence, right? It could be a whole bunch of other films and other genres that are taking something from the way Alien was done. But I agree with you. That scene was enormously suspenseful. Anybody that has any sort of feeling claustrophobia, just the idea of him going into those tunnels, those air vents, or whatever they were supposed to be.
And I don't think it would have been as effective if he was laying down, crawling. I think the fact that he's like crunched up in that, you know, that's what made it.
And also those...
Because he's got to move slow. You can't. There's no moving fast trying to get out of there if the alien does show up, you know.
Right. If he was stupid enough to actually go on the curtain, that wouldn't... He would deserve to die if he'd been that dumb. But the little apertures that close behind him...
Oh, yeah.
Those were disturbing in themselves because... there's a certain finality to it when those close. First of all, you're thinking, if you're a worrywart like me, you're thinking, is somebody going to get caught in one of those?
Or closing, you know?
It has that. The sound effects too are very impressive. Sound effects all through the movie are very impressive. In terms of sound, it's probably one of the most disturbing movies that's ever been made.
Yeah.
But, the Harry Dean Stanton scene is the opposite of the Tom Skerritt death scene, because in Harry Dean Stanton's case, he's out in this very large room, this enormous, almost cathedral-like space. But still, the suspense is tremendous because Scott puts the camera right in his face for long periods of time. And when you see that, you think, well, what's going on, you know, behind him? What's going on off to the side? We can't see, and it drives you nuts when you're watching it. You keep waiting for something to happen. It's very suspenseful. But I suppose for a modern audience, since they know all the surprises, it probably doesn't work quite as well. It's not as effective. But it's still, I think, we were talking about whether or not we should focus on just this movie or talk about the whole series.
Yeah.
Personally, I think everything after the second film is not worth discussing. John Hurt said that he felt that all the other movies in the series were basically action adventure movies, but that this movie was unusual because it was realistic. It was reasonable. You know, the things that the people do sort of make sense in the context of the story. There's no absurd leaps. I mean, frankly, when you get to the point like with Alien 4, where you're talking about Sigourney Weaver's character being a clone of the original person, and she has like superpowers or alien type powers, you know, it's like, you know, we're in comic book land now.
Yeah.
And that's so far away from what the original film was. The original film was, we're going to try to make this as convincing as possible. You're actually going to feel like you're in a spaceship. And the alien creature is really going to be alien. It's not just going to be some Shakespearean actor with a piece of rubber on his head, you know, or something like that. It's going to be something you'd never seen before. And so
I was going to say, I'm watching some of the behind the scenes and documentary stuff. Veronica Cartwright did mention that this was kind of a Hitchcock movie.
Right.
I couldn't figure out what she was referring to or what she meant by that. Or,
well, maybe she was, having been in The Birds,
Birds,
a little girl, Maybe she just naturally was thinking in those terms. I suppose I can see what she is saying. I mean, if nothing else, Hitchcock was the great master of building suspense. And a lot of the techniques that that Scott uses in this film probably are taken from the approach that Hitchcock took. The big difference that I see is that Hitchcock never used like a documentary style approach.
Yeah.
Whereas Ridley Scott in this film uses that constantly. The scenes, for instance, when they're landing the spaceship and something goes wrong and there's a lot of confusion and smoke and fire and things, a lot of crosstalk on the intercoms. That almost has like a documentary feel. That feels like if a camera was on a ship at sea during a sea battle, that would be the sort of effect you get. The lighting and everything about it is meant to create a complete feeling of realism. And it's not that the technology was necessarily accurate. I mean, there's no way for us to know what spaceships are going to look like hundreds of years from now.
Yeah.
But it was accurate in the sense that it felt right.
Yes.
Yeah. Stuff that they were using, like cathode ray tube TVs and things like that, obviously that's not accurate to the time, the future that the film is set in, but it feels right. It feels real. It's probably one of the most convincing depictions of space travel that I've seen in films, despite the fact that the actual miniature stuff that they do outside the ship is not really state of the art, even for that time.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't use motion control cameras. And if you watch, like I watched the DVD version that they put out. They put out the four films on DVD, I guess it must be 10 years or so, 15 years ago. And the advantage to that is that it's the original theatrical version of the first film, which is what I wanted to watch.
Yeah, that's the one I watched.
Yeah, that's the best version, I think. But the when you watch that, you can see that some of the spaceship shots, there are certain imperfections in them. You know, they're not completely seamless. And it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter at all, because what's going on inside the ship is so convincing that, you know, you don't even care. By that time, I mean, this film came out 2 years after Star Wars. And by that time, we had seen so many movies that had spaceships flying in space, you know, that we were pretty much past the point that it's going to impress us no matter how well it's done. So the fact that it didn't look like they fussed over that too much, they just got functional stuff. That was fine, you know, and it allowed us to shift our attention to the more important things that were going on inside, you know. But that was that year, 1979, there were a lot of movies that had special effects and a lot of movies that had science fiction themes and horror themes. Matter of fact, Newsweek had what I guess has become kind of a famous cover. Hollywood Scary Summer was the headline, with a picture of Sigourney Weaver's face. And it covered all the horror movies that were coming out that year, including Prophecy, which turned out to be a stinker, the Amityville Horror, which I guess it's up to you to decide.
Yeah.
That's a stinker, not a favorite of mine. The Black Hole, of course, was Disney's very elaborate science fiction movie, not very good. Moonraker was James Bond's venture into outer space.
Space, right.
Nightwing was a movie about a plague of bats, I think, that was put out by one of the major studios. That turned out to be a bomb. The Frank Langella version of Dracula came out in 79. And of course, Star Trek, the motion picture. Star Trek, the motion picture, it's interesting that that came out the same year as Alien. To me, it's even more interesting than the fact that the Black Hole came out.
Yeah.
Black Hole, we could pretty much dismiss. But Star Trek, the motion picture was at the time one of the most expensive movies ever made. And the stiffness and the fakeness. And I love Star Trek. I watch it no matter what. Well, let's be honest, that movie was pretty stiff and boring and uninspiring. To have that come out the same year as Alien, and to have Alien be so cheap in comparison. I mean, the budget on Alien was much lower than Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
So you had all those people working, all those very talented people working on Star Trek the Motion Picture, and they ended up with this big, shiny, I won't say a turd, but sort of an inert object that didn't really impress him. But an alien, on the other hand, just because they decided to go outside the normal folks that would be working in Hollywood and going with people like Giger and some of the other artists that contributed to the design of the suits and the designs of the ships and all that, and the interiors of the ships. People that came from Heavy Metal, the French
magazine, yeah.
Like Mobius. And I guess there's a bunch of others. I won't list them all, but you know the guys.
Yeah.
I think Ron Cobb and was it Mike Polo? I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name. Whole bunch of people that really created a tremendous contribution, because beyond just coming up with the final designs, they came up with all sorts of stuff that sort of got the filmmakers' imaginations going, right? All sorts of elaborate things that you could say, this must have been very exciting and inspiring for the folks that were making the movie, to have this enormous amount of creativity coming in from all quarters, all sorts of different designs of the interiors of the ship, stuff that may or may not have been used. I think some of these actually might be Ridley Scott's.
Yeah.
It just makes a big difference, because suddenly you're seeing exactly what an audience wants to see, which is something we haven't seen before. You know, that's the promise that a movie like this makes. And Alien, for once, really, really did that.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those, everything came together. If one person that was involved in this movie was not on it, you wouldn't have had, like if they wouldn't have gotten H.R. Giger to do the designs, wouldn't have worked. Whatever they would have gotten other than that wouldn't have worked.
Right. And you just have to look at some of the designs that they were thinking of Dan O'Bannon's. And you say, yeah, that would have been great for a Corman movie. And actually, Corman was interested in the film.
Doing it, yeah.
They took it to Corman first, and he was willing to do it. But it would have been a tiny little horror movie, and it would have been something that would have been completely different in its effect, if not its plot, than this. But that process, you watched that documentary. It's like a 3-hour documentary.
I watched one called Memory, and then there was another one.
Right. Memories is the most recent one. But The Beast Within,
yeah,
which is a terrific documentary. I forgot the name of the guy who directed it. He's actually somebody that works with Ridley Scott. I guess he's in charge of doing all the special editions, the DVDs and things, and supplementary stuff for Scott movies. But that really is probably the most comprehensive documentary I've seen about the making of a film. They talked to all the important people. The only people that I didn't see in that were, I guess, Yaphet Kotto didn't show up, Ian Holm didn't show up in it, but just about everybody else says their piece. And Dan O'Bannon, particularly, the film sort of starts, just like Memories, the other documentary that you mentioned, it starts with him because he's the guy that came up with the original idea. Him working with Ron Shusett, I guess is the pronunciation of his name. He came up with this idea, which was, I guess, a continuation of his thinking of what he wanted to do from Dark Star.
Dark Star, yeah.
Dark Star was a little student film, I guess, that he did with John Carpenter. It received theatrical release. It had a lot of interesting things in it, but it was unsatisfying to him because it was a comedy and the monster in it was a beach ball.
Yeah.
So I remember seeing Dark Star in a revival house after Alien, because after the success of Alien, and I guess Halloween eventually popped up. It was Halloween 80 or 81, somewhere in there, when the first Halloween movie came out.
Yeah.
So Dark Star was sort of put out in some revival houses or midnight screenings. It's the guy who did Alien and the guy who did Halloween. Everybody thought, oh, great. And of course, it's not really that impressive.
Yeah, no. I tracked it down after I watched, because Return of the Living Dead is one of my favorite.
I know, you mentioned
like that, movies. Yeah. And of course, that was Dan O'Bannon. And I was watching it with commentary, and he was talking about his first movie, Dark Star, and how I guess George Lucas was just impressed. Like, how did you do that movie? You know, it's just a beach ball and all this. I was like, well, I've got to see this. So I tracked it down and watched it.
Well, I mean, for what it was impressive. It's just that I guess there was a part of us that were thinking, And I was thinking, this is going to be something really astonishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, he uses a lot of techniques that I guess Kubrick used in 2001, the cutouts on glass, I guess, for the spaceships and things like that. And, you know, for its time, it was impressive. But you can sort of see the ideas there. I mean, just
yeah.
beyond the fact that it's like average Joes working as astronauts, like truckers in space. I guess in Dark Star, they're technically scientists. I don't recall exactly what their job is, but they're regular folks living in a sort of regular lived-in environment in space, and they end up being chased around by an alien, you know. So his desire was to take that germ of an idea and to do it in a convincing way, to make it do a serious film where yeah. the alien would really be convincing. And I guess he was one of the, because he was working on Jodorowsky's Doom, the ill-fated production
yeah.
of Doom. And for some reason, I guess Jodorowsky saw Dark Star and he said, I want you to work on my film. And he actually, I don't know where in Europe they were shooting it or where they were planning it, but he traveled to Europe and spent some time there working on designs and things like that. And eventually that project fell through. But that put him in a good position because he had met all the other guys that were working on Doom, including Giger, I assume, and Mobius. So those were people that he could go back home when he started to pitch Alien, which he, I guess he originally called Star Beast.
Star Beast, yeah.
He could say, these are the people that could make bring this to life. These are the people that could make this, you know, an impressive film. And they originally got the script, found its way into the hands of Walter Hill. And Walter Hill, you know, I like some Walter Hill movies. He's a talented guy. And I guess you could say that he is responsible for a style of screenplay writing that is unique and has been very influential. But he doesn't sound like a terribly nice guy.
Yeah.
To be honest. Anyway, they had a production company called Brandywine, which was him and Gordon Carroll and David Giler, I think his name was. There are some unpleasant things that are said about those two guys by Dan O'Bannon and also by other people that have worked with them on the subsequent Alien sequels. But we'll leave them out of the picture because they're not really important.
Yeah.
The important thing is that after doing one treatment, one draft, Walter Hill did a draft of Dan O'Bannon's script. There's a lot of debate as to how much he changed, how much is attributable to him and how much is attributable to Dan O'Bannon. It appears that Dan O'Bannon was able to sort of create a connection with Ridley Scott when he finally came in.
Yeah.
He had done one other film at that point, which actually I saw when it first came out because everybody was talking about how it was similar to Barry Lyndon and he was maybe possibly the next Kubrick. And I guess just based on that reputation, they reached out to him. Most of the other big directors weren't interested or weren't available. So they reached out to him. He came on board and him and Dan O'Bannon, I guess, made a connection,
yeah.
possibly because he recognized that Dan O'Bannon was a real science fiction nut. And Ridley Scott wasn't. He didn't really particularly like. So Dan O'Bannon was the one who actually presented H.R. Giger's stuff to Scott. And Scott says when he saw that, he said, well, that's
it. That was it, yeah.
Our search is over. We know exactly what the alien is supposed to look like. Because that was the real question mark, was how would you do something that would really be scary? I mean, they wanted to do it as an A film, and they sold it to 20th Century Fox on the basis of the idea that this wasn't going to be a B movie.
It would
be B movie material, but it would be treated like an A film. And that's reflected not just in how the story was, how the script was reworked, but also in terms of the elaborate sets, the attention to detail, and also the really high quality cast that they hired. I mean, what a terrific cast.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Incidentally, John Finch, who was the guy who starred in Hitchcock's Frenzy, he was originally going to play the role that eventually was played by John Hurt. He actually worked one day on the film, and he became so ill that they actually, according to Ridley Scott, they had to actually carry him off the set. And John Hurt, who had been offered the role originally, wasn't available. He was called in as a sort of last minute replacement. I think he was like, they asked him if he wanted it, and he was there the next day working. Yeah. So him and Yaphet Kotto, who was a tremendous actor, you know, a really dynamic presence in this movie and in just about every movie he did.
Oh, yeah.
Veronica Cartwright, who had a long, you know, history and is a very, you know, unusual screen presence. John Hurt, Ian Holm, who I don't think had done any major films. He certainly hadn't done any science fiction films prior to this. One of the best British actors of his time, right? I mean, just between him and John Hurt, you know, that's terrific. You know, that's all you need right there. Tom Skerritt, who was, you know, was in Altman's MASH. And
He was perfect in this role. Yeah. Just sold it.
Everybody was, there was this sort of casual feeling that really added to that documentary effect, that you were just sort of catching people just as they were, that the camera just happened to be there. The conversations have that sort of loose, spontaneous feel that makes it completely believable.
Yeah, and a small crew. You don't have all these other extra. I mean, you mentioned that in talking about Star Trek, it was better later on when they just had the smaller crew. You know what I'm saying? We just have these, what, eight people.
Well,
that
I think
have to deal with.
I think that the it's true of Star Wars as well, that when you have people that are seem like contemporary, you know, contemporary to our time,
yeah,
regular folks, right? A farm boy and a hot rodder, you know, they seem like people we can relate to, and they behave on screen like regular folks. And with the later Star Wars movies, they started focusing more and more on Jedi masters and all these people that speak in a sort of fake sort of
royalty.
Right? They have that sort of formal or fake Shakespearean quality to the dialogue. And right away, that distance you don't believe it. It's like watching old Flash Gordon serials.
Yeah.
But in this, these are people that look like real people, you know. And so, in a horror movie where we're going to be asked to care about what happens to these people, that's essential, right? I mean, what could be more important than believing that these people are real people that actually exist in the space? The fact that he referenced the old Dark House movies. But he approached this in the style or with the same sort of approach that they were using more frequently in what the way we call the new Hollywood movies, shooting in real places. Well, you couldn't shoot in a real place with this movie, right? They weren't going to go into outer space and they weren't going to be able to find a spaceship. But they built the sets so that they were completely contained, apparently. So once you went into the set, you had to walk through the whole ship
to come out.
So that created this sort of claustrophobic feeling with the actors. They really felt like they were in a spaceship because there was nothing else. There was no other point of reference, right? It wasn't as if they were looking at an open wall with all the crew and a bunch of people smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. So doing that and also using practical lights, this is something that Kubrick was doing towards the end with Eyes Wide Shut. All or most of the lighting was practical lights. Whatever lights were being used on the set, in other words, all the lights that were part of the set,
the panels, yeah,
that was what was illuminating the actors. So right away, you're, you know, creating a feeling of realism that you're never going to get if you're shooting it with a bunch of lights that have everything perfectly lit and, you know, the old-fashioned Hollywood style of doing things. That made a big difference, I think. And when you watch those opening scenes where we're sort of going through the ship before they wake up, you really feel like you're in a real place.
Yeah.
It's got to be one of the most impressive sets anybody ever made, right? I mean, it really is extraordinary. And that you could spend so much time going through it and build suspense just by sort of creeping through this environment is a real testament to his skill as a director, right? Before we've even seen a human face, we're already beginning to feel a little nervous. You know, there's a little vent or something on one of the panels or near one of the panel control panels. And as we're going through that shot, that long shot, as they go through the ship before the crew wakes up, there's a little burst of air that causes some of the papers to flutter.
Yeah.
And there are little things that are sort of bobbing and jumping before the computer comes on. And those things were kind of like, well, you know, what's happening? You know, the audience reacted to that. Building that feeling of, you don't know what's going to happen. Anything could jump out at any time from any corner, from any, you know, the shadows. That really begins to create this sort of feeling of suspense that is almost unbearable in some scenes.
Yeah. Do you think they had Jonesy on here just so they could do a cat jump scare? Is that the only reason they have a cat in space?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I've heard anybody. It must have been in fairly early in the drafts because I know Sigourney Weaver said in that documentary that she thought she was allergic to the cat.
To the
They had like four cats. She was worried because she was afraid that they would probably find it easier to replace her than
a cat. Cats.
So the cats must have been an important part of the thing right from the start. That was probably part of the concept. It is kind of a funny idea that while all the humans are running around out of their minds trying to find an escape or a solution to this problem, the cat is just sort of lounging
around, corner,
and it's one of two crew members that survives. Right?
I think the first time I watched, I kept thinking at the end, that cat's going to, that chest, it's going to burst out of that cat.
I think that's what
the ending was going to be, but then it didn't happen.
And I think that shot where you see the alien sort of peering down at the carrying case with the cat in it, that was meant to give the audience the idea that there was going to be something in the cat. So that is another way where he sort of distracted us from what really was going to happen. But, that feeling of realism and the building of suspense, I think, is probably what made the film so memorable and so impactful when I first saw it. When you watch some of the gore scenes or shock scenes now, they aren't quite as gory and quite as shocking as I originally remember them, which sort of makes me think that it's the skill in the filmmaking and then the editing that made them so effective in the first place.
Yeah, I think before I watched it today, I think the last time I'd seen it was whenever those DVDs came out that you mentioned. So it's been that long since I'd seen it before. And there's just stuff, you know, there's stuff you forget about. So I kept thinking it's bloodier than what it was. And well, I mean, obviously the chest burster scene is pretty bloody, but the rest of the movie's not. I mean, all the other death scenes, you really don't see anything.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how that happens, where a movie gets a reputation for being so horrifying and so disgusting that people are actually passing out or puking. And then you go and you watch it after some years and you realize it doesn't really have that. It's true of Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well. It doesn't really have that much in it.
Yeah.
It's the...
For some reason, I remember the Lambert character being picked up by the tail. You know what I'm saying? Because it just, you know, just shows it coming up from behind her, and that's it. Cuts away to a scream. You don't see anything at all.
Well, she makes this sort of strange noise that we hear over that. And I think the idea was supposed to be that spear at the end of the tail is supposed to penetrate a person's back and lift them up or hold them in place while the alien...
I was thinking I saw that happen the first, you know what I'm saying, but I didn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, I forget what movie we were talking about recently where, I guess it was Phantasm, where we kept recalling. I thought that there was a scene where, it was suggested, it would look like the movie was heading in that direction.
I'm sure they've done it 100 times in the sequels, and that's what I'm thinking of. But
well, maybe so. Yeah. See, I'm fortunate in that I didn't bother. I think I watched the third. I tried to watch it some night when I was really drunk, so I don't really remember it. But the fourth I passed on, even though I have it, I wouldn't be bothered to watch it. And all the things like the Alien Predator movies, I just don't see any point in that, you know.
Yeah.
I can understand why the sort of fanboy crowd wants that. I know that there are some people that will say about the first movie, I like the fact that you didn't see stuff.
Yeah.
But there's going to be an equal number of people that say, oh, I wish we had seen
more. Had seen more, yeah.
I wish we know more about the space jockey and what his past was and how did he come to be there and what was he doing with those eggs.
Well, when you get to Prometheus, you realize, oh, okay, I don't really care.
Well, that's
It's
the
not
problem,
as
right?
Yeah, it's not as elaborate, as exciting, or that you just like, ah, oh, that was kind of boring.
The problem is, and this is true of a lot of the streaming series that keep these ideas sort of floating out there for seasons, is that when you finally get to the answer, you realize it probably would have been better if we didn't know, right? Because there's no way they can come up with an answer or a history, a backstory that is going to be satisfying. The reason why we're intrigued in the first place is because we don't know those things.
We don't
things,
know, yeah. Right?
But you're always going to have those folks who say, and I think even in this documentary, one of the people that was involved in the production said, I'd love to find out what happened with the space jockey and what his history is and all that sort of thing. And I think that for some people, they find the suspense of not knowing so unbearable. The only way they can really grapple with this, the only reason, way they can really come to feel comfortable with it is to know all these details and have all this backstory and all these histories of the different types of aliens and all the biological functions of the alien and how it, none of that stuff is really important. It actually hurts the story to put it in, but they just, in order to manage this, in order to feel good about the experience, they have to know all that stuff.
Yeah.
So those sequels are made for them, I guess. Although I don't see how any of those sequels could really be satisfying to anybody, you know. There are some, I guess you could say, lapses in the plot. Like, for instance, just from the standpoint of logic, I would say that if you're on a ship with a creature like that, you probably should just get to the shuttle, seal it, and take off.
Yeah.
You don't bother setting the auto-destruct mechanism. Now, I can understand why the people in this ship may have had such feelings of hatred and resentment for the corporation or the company that did this to them, that intentionally put them in harm's way, that they may say, well, we have to make sure we destroy the ship so they won't get the alien, right? They won't get the thing that they wanted. So that's possibly a motivation. It seems to me that if you're in that sort of situation of complete stark terror and you just want to get away from the thing that's killing everybody,
you're not going to care about revenge or getting back at the man.
Just get to the shuttle. And I suppose if they had done that right away while three of them were still alive, they could just stay in the shuttle, keep the door closed. There's only one door. This sounds similar to the discussion we had about Night of the Living Dead. And they know that the creature has to stay out, right? Can't get in. If they want to, they could take turns sleeping. If they want to go to, you know, one can go to sleep for a couple of months and then wake up, and the other one can go to sleep for a couple of months. And so there's always somebody on duty in case the creature does find a way to get in. They can respond. And they won't be caught napping. But if they're in that situation, then the big Nostromo ship is presumably on a course towards Earth or towards someplace where they're going to be able to be picked up. The shuttle will be taken along with it. Presumably Nostromo probably is got more resources than the little shuttle.
Yeah.
So if you ever did find yourself in a situation where you need to make a course correction or you need to get more food or more coolant or whatever they need, you can make a journey into the ship briefly and get those things, right? You haven't taken yourself away from the ship and blown it up along with all the resources that you might need.
Yeah.
So that would be my strategy. But it's also true that when people are in a situation like that where they're panicking, they're probably not thinking clearly, right? They can't strategize.
No sort of faster than light travel in this one, right?
Yeah, well, that's another interesting
question. Or they just never mention it. I guess they're just using the cryogenic sleep to do long travel.
I guess so, but I don't know if that would really work. I mean, it's hard to imagine that even with cryogenic sleep, that you would be able to, it would be beyond the lifetime of a human being.
Yeah.
Even in that sort of cryogenic freeze, to get to a a solar system that has alien life forms like these creatures, like the
space. By the time they get back to Earth, everybody that hired them for that job is dead.
Well, of course, in the sequel, they play with that idea a little bit with Sigourney Weaver learning that her daughter has grown up and died, I guess.
Yeah.
But the question is, would anybody who's doing that sort of work, would any of them leave loved ones behind? I mean, if you had a loved one, you wouldn't go off on a space mission where you could easily be detoured and you might spend years out in space. Yeah. Right? So I don't know. I think that's one of those things, just like with Star Trek, where they sort of are ignoring the realities of, I guess that's what, relativity?
That
time passes differently for objects that are moving away.
People in space, yeah.
But I guess, we can't be too particular about those things. There probably are other lapses in logic, but it seems to me mostly it's pretty reasonable and it's pretty practical in the way it sort of proceeds. One thing follows the other. There are no ridiculous lapses in logic or continuity. It works pretty well, I would say, as a story.
Yeah, I think the face hugger sells it for me. I think it's because it looked so real, because it was. I mean, they obviously use shellfish and oysters for it, but that's what sold it right there, that face hugger.
Yeah. So be able to do.
Nasty.
Yeah, it really did. Those close ups were unusual too. Usually with makeup stuff like that, or any sort of props, special effects props, they would sort of keep the camera back a little bit so you don't see it in detail. But they put so much time and effort into those props that they could get right up close and give you a very close view of them, but that documentary approach also can be seen. It's almost like a Kubrickian approach in like those scenes where Ian Holm is at his station and he's looking at the specimen and the camera is sort of behind him and we're expecting some sort of shock scene, and it turns out to be Sigourney Weaver stepping up behind him. And the camera stays on Ian Holm. And we hear Sigourney Weaver talking to him. And it's only when they get to a certain point in the scene when the camera turns or cuts to her.
For her, yeah.
That approach to shooting a scene is unusual. Normally, they would have the usual shot, reverse shot, and dialogue. And they probably wouldn't have the length of the scenes. The scenes are quite long, I don't think the term leisurely would be right because there doesn't seem to be anything leisurely about a suspense film of this sort.
Yeah.
But it seems to be intentionally slow so that we're constantly questioning what's going to happen next,
Yeah, well, there's scenes whenever they're at the dinner table and it's just one, one shot, everybody's in frame. But then that one scene, I guess it's right after one of them had died and Yaphia Kotto was going to leave. Well, the camera doesn't follow him. He walks, into the background, is out of focus and is still part of the scene talking, having dialogue, and the camera just stays there.
Right. Yeah. Well, some of that's, I think I know the one you're talking about. It's the one with Sigourney Weaver in the foreground and she's sort of puzzling. And then she starts getting into a shouting match with some of those scenes do seem, according to that documentary, at least, there's a certain amount of improvisation there. They show us some alternate takes.
Yeah.
Where Yaphet Kotto was saying slightly different things. And it seems
The scene where Tom Skerritt gets up and goes into the background to get with Veronica Cartwright. And they're just now they're back there having their own conversation. separate from what we were just watching.
Right. Yeah. The interpretation of that filmmaker that did the Memories documentary was that was Tom Skerritt leaving the working class guys and going sort of moving between the two classes. I guess that's kind of hard to avoid the fact that there is a class distinction here, right? You got the below deck people and the above deck people. What I liked about it is, and this is one of the reasons why I didn't care for the edited, the special edition that they did where they put certain material back in. What I liked about it is even though there's a distinction between the classes And you can tell that, you know, Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton's characters don't particularly like these other people.
Right.
They still get along.
Yes. Yeah.
There is an open hostility because anybody in that situation, you know, they would realize you're on the ship with these people. You have to go get along.
Yeah.
People insult you, you nod and smile, right? Or you get in on the joke. But they had that one scene where after John Hurt has been put into the medical observation room, and Dallas and Ian Holmes' character are working on him, the other characters are outside and they're observing through a window, and Sigourney Weaver comes in and Veronica Cartwright launches herself, "You bitch," and smacks her.
Yeah.
And apparently they did that a couple of times to try to get it right. And then they eventually cut it out of the theatrical version. And when Ridley Scott did his restored version or special edition, he put that scene back in. And I don't think it works, because that brings us close to almost like soap opera melodramatics.
Yeah.
You know, "You bitch," smacking people around, you know. These people in this situation, they would hold all those resentments inside of them. That would be part of the stress of a space journey, is not being able to launch yourself at the other people and hit them when you get angry at them. Now, people might say, well, Veronica Cartwright's character is being established as kind of an emotional person because she's crying a lot in the film. But she's also a controlled person. You can see that a lot of times when she hears bad news, like you're going out on the search party, you know, "Sound great," you know, and she sort of swallows it. She doesn't like it, but she doesn't jump up and start, you know, screaming at people. They're all pressurized as much as the ship is, right? They all are holding in their emotions and feelings. And we can all appreciate this because we have to do it every time we go to work.
Yep.
Every work environment has a certain amount of that. So it's immediately recognizable, especially to working class people, right? You can immediately say, "Yes, I can see," or "This resembles reality."
Yeah.
And it also adds that additional layer of stress and tension to it, because we don't know how much we can trust anybody, right? We don't really know. I mean, obviously, they're laying the groundwork for the revelation that Ian Holmes' character is completely untrustworthy. And that doesn't come as a complete surprise, or I shouldn't say that, it doesn't come as an implausible surprise, because we never really feel like we know everybody that well. We never really know if we can trust people. I mean, Dallas, Tom Skerritt's character, he actually says that. "I don't trust
anybody." Trust anybody, yeah. Right.
And she's asking him, can we trust Ian Holmes' character, right? What's his name? Ash, is it?
Yeah, Ash.
The few times when the movie sort of floats closer to that sort of old-fashioned type, histrionical, melodramatic type stuff, that's probably when it starts to sound a little fake as far as the dialogue is concerned.
Right.
It's better if it's colder, you know. That's the thing that we should learn from Stanley Kubrick, that The Shining, it's not my favorite Kubrick film, but it works because we're distanced from it. We're just observing. We don't feel like he's pulling the strings, like a sort of a Spielbergian approach,
right?
Trying to make us laugh one moment and cry the next, and you know, fear the next. It's distanced, so that you don't know what to expect, and that's a far more upsetting and unsettling feeling.
When you go back and watch, like rewatch it, and I kind of noticed it today, whenever the right before the chest burster scene. The Ian Holm character, he knows what's coming.
Yes.
Every time they show him, he knows that there's something inside this guy and it's going to come out.
Right.
Every time they show him, he just has that look of like, okay, I'm getting ready for it. He's anticipating and he's waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
Just but without saying anything. That's the way they shot it.
And he almost
at him and you're just like, okay, this guy knows.
He almost has, in some of the shots, almost like a little smile on his face.
Yeah, like he's excited for it.
When he sneaks up on Sigourney Weaver as she's finally learning from Mother what what's going on.
What the plan is, yeah.
And he says, with a little bit of a smile, he says, there's an explanation for all this, or I can explain all of this.
Yeah.
And very satisfying for the audience when she just sort of belts him, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody, unfortunately, that sort of set him off. And, you know, the little bit of the HAL 9000 effect there.
Right.
He apparently has some mental illness issues for a robot, more than you would expect.
And we talk about a lack of gore. The inside of that android is the nastiest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
The white milk, and I don't know what those little
look like pearl onions.
Yeah. Fiber optic cable in there.
Well, I really appreciated it the first time I saw it, because it would have been so easy for them to just do what every other movie would do and just have a bunch of circuit boards or whatever.
Circuit boards and wires.
Wires and things like that coming out. So I really appreciate the fact that they said, no, this is completely different technology and it's going to look, it has to look different. I'm not, Ridley Scott talked about the problem they have with the rubber head. I think that probably is the weakest special effect in the film.
Yeah.
But it doesn't damage the effectiveness of the scene.
I think they hold on it too long before they cut to his actual head whenever they do the cut. I think if they just wouldn't have had almost a minute of her trying to get the head to set up right. And then it finally cuts and you're like, okay, now that was obviously a rubber head.
Yeah. You can tell from the weight of it that there's no way you could actually get that head to sit up.
Yeah.
The flimsy little rubber stuff that it looks like a mask.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like that is all just the flash part that would be normally cut off if you were making a rubber mask. But the speech that he gives is so effective.
Yeah, you just don't care.
You know, mine, because that makes the scene work, you know. So, and also the filmmaking is very inventive. I mean, obviously they couldn't do what they wanted to do. So they found ways using editing to make it work. And that's what good filmmaking is all about, right?
Yeah.
And I prefer that to, you know, CGI all the time.
Yeah, I think the shot should have been, we see the back of the android head. They set it down, the camera comes around, and then you cut whenever you go past the actor, kind of rope style, and then when you come around here, now you've got the real head.
Yeah, that's
the way you're not seeing that. You're not seeing that horrible looking fake face.
Well, also, I think it probably would have made more sense if they just had the head lying sideways on the table.
Sideways, yeah.
Rather than trying to prop it up.
Trying to set it up.
I realize that would be kind of difficult because
a little bit uncomfortable. Yeah.
Has to actually have his head in there. But there were ways it could have been done. It could have been shot sideways, you know, so it would look like the head was laying flat.
Laying on an incline underneath the table, I guess.
But I guess what Ridley Scott said with the budget that they had and with the schedule that they had, there was no redoing anything, really. If there's something went wrong, you just had to go with it.
Yeah. One of the documentaries was talking about how, I guess, studio execs were on set trying to rush him through it. Why are you not doing this? Why are you not saying?
Yeah, it surprised me to hear that.
It's
hard to imagine anybody looking at those rushes and saying, we got to hurry these guys up.
Yeah.
You know, but there might be some people, and this might be true of the two producers, supposed producers, that Walter Hill's production company was formed from, Giler and Carroll, I guess, Gordon Carroll and David Giler. I mean, they're fellows that really haven't done anything. I think one of them is dead now. I don't think either one of them are going to be remembered as geniuses of cinema. And yet they found themselves in a position where they could make believe they knew better than Ridley Scott.
Thank you.
fellow who wrote one of the screenplays for Alien 3 was a novelist, and I don't remember his name right now, but I just saw a podcast that he was on. He's the fellow that ended up writing the novel that Sideways was based on.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And apparently he was married to a woman who at the time was Walter Hill's assistant. And he was getting all the different drafts of the scripts for Alien 3. And eventually he managed to get himself in, so he was one of the screenwriters, wrote a draft. And I guess the director of that, it was David Fincher, right?
I believe so, yeah.
He liked
he started. Draft. He started. Did he actually finish that?
He did, yes.
Okay.
And he liked the script that this guy had written. He brought him onto the film, and apparently Walter Hill and David Giler and Gordon Carroll, they disliked him, and he was unwise enough to write a memo to someone where he said that Walter Hill was basically a hack, or that the other producers, were Hill included, yeah, were hacks that were living off their past successes. And so after a while, Walter Hill, he let things play out for a while, and then he came back onto the production, and he basically said, you're going to do my script.
Right.
This is after everybody had been prepared to do this guy's script, his version, the one that David Fincher liked.
Like, yeah.
And David Fincher was given the option of quitting or doing Walter Hill's version. So Walter Hill and these other guys, they don't sound like very nice guys, and they sound like people that are interested in things beyond the quality of the finished film.
Right.
Sound like guys who enjoy the power and the prestige. I won't say that they're on the level of a Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
But some of the stories that this writer was telling on this podcast suggested that they really had more interest in the extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
And they were really just worried more about their power, their position of power. And that's why, as soon as this fellow was foolish enough to make this comment about them, he had to go, right? Because they couldn't allow that. They couldn't allow their reputations or their standing with the studio to be damaged in that way. But you come away with a feeling that these aren't good people, you know?
Yeah.
These are the type of people that you fear you will meet if you work in the film industry. And sure enough, they are there. But all that unpleasantness aside, in the case of Alien, Walter Hill's contributions to the script actually did improve it, even by Dan O'Bannon's and Ron Suchet's statement. They feel too that his addition of the Ash character, that subplot involving Ash and
right,
the robot, that was a good addition, and it gave them that extra shock scene, right, that extra surprise in the film, which it really needed. So Walter Hill, you know, he's a talented guy. We understand he's a talented screenwriter, and he's made some good films. So he was able to bring something to Alien. He wasn't able to bring much to any of the subsequent films.
Yeah.
Maybe he's just putting his name on it because he has the right to now. But in addition to the scene of Veronica Cartwright slapping Sigourney Weaver, another scene that was added into the special edition was that scene of Sigourney Weaver finding Dallas's body in a cocoon towards the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's funny because
for some reason I kept waiting for that in this movie. I was like, where's that scene? Well, so I guess, well, I'm remembering from the
You must have seen the director's cut. Yeah. I saw the director's cut in the theater when they reissued it. There were a lot of, you know, little things like that bothered me, because my feeling is that when you have a movie that's pretty close to being perfect, you can make some changes that might improve it. There are little right, obvious things that you can fix with the special effects and whatnot, but to actually add in stuff and risk damaging the very delicate balance that you achieved, that doesn't seem like a good idea, particularly at that late stage of the movie.
Oh yeah.
You know, Tom Skerritt said in that documentary that he thought it was unwise because you're racing for curtain. You're trying to get the movie over with, right? This is the moment of supreme suspense. This is, you're going to be able to escape the ship, and they're going to stop and have a chat.
Chad, yeah.
So that was unwise. And it doesn't work too, because it's not really very convincingly done. The makeup and the set don't really seem to have had as much time put into them as the other parts of the film. And it also points to a problem with the basic premise, which is we don't really understand how this whole process works. Is it possible that the alien is actually developed? First of all, we'll overlook the fact that the alien goes from being like this big to being taller than a man.
Yeah.
In what I assume is the space of a day or two, right? I mean, we don't have a clear idea how much time is
passed. Yeah.
But it's very quickly. He goes, you know, as Harry Dean Stanton picks up the little shed skin, and that's still the little creature, and apparently the next step is 7-foot-tall monster.
Yeah.
But we'll overlook that. Okay, that's the way this alien works. That's this. But is it possible that he could grow to that size and also have developed that that wall of that whatever that secretions are that makes those little blobs that Dallas has been stuck to. And I guess he would also have to create an egg, right? Where did the egg come from for the facehugger that infected? I mean, are we saying that the xenomorph has the ability to put a put? I thought the whole process was that the egg has to have the facehugger come out, and the facehugger does. So where is the facehugger in this? The only facehugger in this is the one that hits John Hurt. How has Dallas been infected or impregnated? So yeah, it causes us to think too much about parts of the film.
Yeah,
best not think about. You know, you shouldn't dwell on that. So I'm glad that the theatrical version is the version is a version that is still available, and you can see the theatrical version, and you don't have to have those missteps added back in. You know, this is a real plague nowadays.
People adding still, yeah.
Yeah, you never can feel like you've seen a movie, because a few years go by and they say, oh, he's a new version, you know. and I think that's important. You know, people should be wise enough, and I think Ridley Scott is, I hope he is, should be wise enough to say, whatever I might have thought or felt, the movie came out and it was enormous success and everybody loved it. So leave it the fuck alone.
Yeah, stop adding to it, yeah.
plenty of movies that he did where he trusted his judgment and they didn't turn out so well.
Yeah.
So in this case, did turn out well. Trust the voice of the people. The people are saying you did it right. Leave it alone. Right? Don't monkey around with it.
Yeah. No, I did see, doing research on it, I did see an article, and the title was something like From Science Fiction to Theater, How Ridley Scott Saved Alien.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And I kept thinking, I don't know, I think Dan O'Bannon pretty much had a solid film like there just waiting to be shot. I don't understand.
Yeah, well,
I don't understand why no one really gives Dan O'Bannon enough credit for for Alien.
Well,
just, you know, I think, does it even say written by it, or is it based on
credits?
I think they give him final writing credits on it.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, they may all get credit to some extent. Yeah. I forget the exact. I guess we can add that in to this video when we get a chance to check it afterwards. But I as much as I respect Dan O'Bannon, I do think it's possible that if things had played out differently, he could have ended up with another film that would have been maybe marginally better than Dark Star.
Right.
So it really was the inclusion. Of course, we do give him credit for having the smarts to say Giger.
Yeah.
That's something that he suggested to Ridley Scott. But Ridley Scott really came in with an attitude that I think is very important. And it's an attitude that's sort of being challenged now with the Me Too movement and all that. And some people talking about how Stanley Kubrick might have mistreated Shelley Duvall, which I think is all nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
But there's this thing, well, the auteur is dead. Now movies are all going to be made through some sort of democratic process where everybody gets their voice heard. I don't think that works. I think in a case of something like this, you can see how having too many people trying to put their ideas in, like the Walter Hill and the other producers, that actually impeded progress. It might have made things worse.
Yeah.
The studio people saying, "Oh, you can't build this set, or you're not going to spend this money on the space jockey set. Right? Why do you need a set like that? You're only going to use it for one scene, right?" Go without that, right? Somehow, a guy like Ridley Scott, he had the ability to convince them, no, this really is important. We must have this scene. The success of the movie hinges on it. And that power, that ability to push things through and to get things done doesn't necessarily mean you're always going to end up with a great film. And Ridley Scott's career is proof. You have great films and you can have some not so great films. Hitchcock the same way. But it really is important to have somebody who does have a vision, to use that word that Ridley Scott says he dislikes. He doesn't like to use that word. But you do need to have somebody who says, I can see this movie. And he went so far as to actually storyboard the whole thing even before he was officially hired for the film. They paid him a certain amount. He storyboarded the whole thing. And it was when they saw his storyboards, they said, oh, yes, this can be done. And by the way, here's double the budget.
Yeah.
Now that we see what you're thinking of, we're willing to give you more money. So I really think he was important, you know, and I think he was important in the history of film as well, for maybe not as much as Stanley Kubrick, because Stanley Kubrick really was the one that did this the first time. He was the first person to say, you can do a science fiction movie, you can do a movie about space travel, and you can make it completely convincing. Ridley Scott was smart enough to recognize that that approach was just right for Alien. And as a result, you have a movie that, as you say, you can watch now and still find effective.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Also, I think sometimes when you look at the movies that come in the aftermath of these great films and you see how mangy they are, you know, you can sort of say, oh, that's what it would have been like if a guy like Ridley Scott hadn't been working on it, right? I mean, Corman did a lot of Alien ripoffs after after the success of Alien.
Yeah.
His company was churning out Star Wars ripoffs and Alien ripoffs, sometimes both, you know, one and the same. And there were, some of them are amusing, but they're, you know, in comparison to Alien, it's, you know, there is no comparison.
I think so. I just have a little bit of curiosity of what a Dan O'Bannon directed Alien would have looked like.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. I think he probably would have been smart, because he seems to be kind of an eccentric fellow. I know he was suffering apparently even at the time from Crohn's disease, which right. is a digestive problem. And some people have speculated that maybe that's where he got the idea for the chest burster, that the discomfort he was feeling, internal discomfort, may have put his mind on that path of trying to depict that on the screen. But I don't think that he would have been so unaware of his limitations that he would want it. I mean, if Ridley Scott hadn't presented himself, perhaps he would have taken a bash at it if they had allowed him to. But I have a feeling he probably had a pretty good understanding of what his limitations were. And I think if he was confronted with a guy like Ridley Scott in a film like The Duelists, he probably would have thought, yeah, probably best for him to do it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, some of the people worked on the technical people that worked on the film, I think including the editor, said that, I think it was Tom Skerritt who said it. Said that when he started to see the rushes, he could see how important it was to have a director that paid attention to the visual stuff, you know.
Right.
Because initially, he and the other members of the cast were irritated and frustrated by the fact that Ridley Scott was working as the operator, the camera operator. So he wasn't available to them. He was always, you know.
He done all the handheld shots.
Right. And they seemed to have were made uncomfortable by that. But he was smart enough to know that making them uncomfortable was probably a good idea.
Yeah, I believe he also said he wanted actors that he could just let go and not have yes. to direct the entire time. You know what I'm saying? People that knew how to get in front of the camera, perform. I don't have to really spend a lot of time
right.
with you.
Right. I certainly understand. I think anybody who's ever made a film, whatever the quality, can certainly appreciate how important it is to have people that you don't have to constantly take care of. If you can get people that have some ideas of their own and you can just put the camera on them and you're going to get something, that certainly makes the job easier. And for somebody who's deciding to actually be the camera operator, for a director who's doing that, and if you see some of the pictures of him, not only does he have the big camera in front of him,
yeah.
he also has a black hood over him so that he won't be seen in reflections. To be in that sort of cocoon, not be able to get out there with the actors and say, do this, do that, that really is a handicap. So it must have been very comforting to know that you had several people in the cast that weren't going to be constantly asking for direction. Sigourney Weaver talks about some of her feelings of inadequacy, and that might have actually been felt by other members of the cast as well. There's some of the members of the cast that wondered if she was really up to the job.
Yeah.
But I think she's, you know, this is something we've spoken about. I think when we did the Silence of the Lambs episode, we were talking about great female role models in horror and science fiction films. It's really hard for me to imagine anybody beating or surpassing her, because she is exactly what you would want in that type of character. She's human. She's not unemotional, but but she has she's competent and she's controlled, and she is reasonable, right? And there's none of the sort of baggage that you would normally see with female characters.
Yeah.
She's not interested in having a relationship with anybody. She's not chasing after anybody. She's not offering to make anybody's coffee, you know, which is something you see even in the movie that Alien was so supposedly inspired by, It, the Terror from Beyond Space, which has a couple of female members of the crew. But when the shit starts to hit the fan, the only thing that they can do is bandage people up and make coffee.
Yeah.
So in all those science fiction movies in the past, and some of them were a little ahead of their time as far as the treatment of women, just by allowing the women to participate there, I guess they were ahead of their time. But there was always this sort of arc where the women, as cold and competent and professional as they were at the start, they would always end up in the hero's arms by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
They had that bend towards just being, their ultimate goal was to be a housewife, I guess, to be married to a nice guy. You don't see that with Sigourney Weaver's character. She seems self-contained, you know. She doesn't need anybody else to validate her or to justify her existence. And I also like the fact that they don't always make her win. You know, she's not like an unreasonable superhero.
She's not like a super tough. Right. You know what I'm saying? It's real. It's a more real character.
Right. And even in the scene, like when she confronts Ash, she really doesn't win that conversation. He's able to sort of, you know, get it to back off. But you appreciate the fact that she made a point of it, right? That she didn't let him just go scot-free.
Yeah.
So that's all part of the idea that she is not a superhero, but she's a competent, capable person. The fact that she's the only one that survives, I guess, is proof of her superiority. She doesn't let emotions govern her. And she's like all people who are in a position of command, she's willing to listen to other people and try to, you know, benefit from their knowledge and experience. And I think you could say the same with Dallas as well. Maybe Dallas's big mistake is he didn't let her go down into that airship.
Yeah.
She volunteered to, and he said, no, I'm doing, you know. That's where he sealed his own fate, so to speak. She's very impressive in this film. I mean, besides the fact she's a very beautiful woman.
Yeah, yeah.
But she just seems perfect for that role. And the combination of uncertainty and at the same time being competent and smart is kind of irresistible for a hero of a movie like this. But...
Yeah, as much as I love Aliens, every time I watch it, this, like when I watched this first one and it was ending, I was just like, I can't believe there are sequels. This should just end. We don't need anything, but Aliens is good, I guess.
Well, I mean,
it's different though. It's different.
That's it. I think that's the wise thing that they did was they said, we're not going to try to just replicate what was done there. It's a different type of movie. It's an action adventure movie. It's a war movie. And they're not going to try to ride on the fear of the alien, because we know we're past the point where we really can be scared by the alien anymore.
Yeah, and they don't try to explain the alien anymore in it. It's, I guess we learn more about Weyland Industries than we do the xenomorphs. But
And there's probably a lot of stuff that James Cameron shot for the sequel that didn't make its way into the theatrical cut, which if it had, might have damaged it. Because some of the stuff of the colonists on the planet, that really goes on too long and it's unnecessary. And, you know, it slows everything down and makes it feel like you're watching an epic instead of a sort of tight little, the thing that actually was released in theaters.
Well, it's the same with all horror movies. Your second one has to have higher body count, more blood, right. You know. So,
and
that was the only way they could do this one.
Dawn of the Dead came out in January 1978.
78, yeah.
So it was just a year before Alien. And Dawn of the Dead is similar in that George Romero realized that the fear factor had to have diminished from the first film, right? Because in the first film, everything's at night. We don't really know what's going on. The characters are completely confused and terrorized by what's happening. But by the second film, everybody has sort of adjusted themselves. Everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And they've figured out ways to fight these zombies. And whereas in the first film, going out the front door is like a major production, right? So you're taking your life in hands. By the second film, they're running around amongst the zombies, knocking them over and things. And it's actually because of their the glib sort of careless approach that they take that actually results in one of them, at least, getting too cocky and ending up getting bitten by one of the zombies. So that is an inevitable thing that we has happened back with the Universal monsters as well. Once you get to know the monster, once you see the monster too clearly or completely clearly in detail, it doesn't scare us anymore. Then you have to do a different type of story.
Different, yeah.
Right? And that's what they did with Aliens. They said, okay, it's not going to be a horror movie. It's going to be an action movie. And instead of having one alien, we're going to have a bunch of aliens. And that's a clever idea. I thought it worked very well. It was very effective. You know, it's a real crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
Alien, perhaps not as much of a crowd pleaser. It's too unsettling, and a film to really be a crowd. It's not a popcorn movie, you know.
Yeah. I was thinking when you were talking about like Dawn of the Dead and stuff. I was sort of thinking, Alien is basically Night of the Living Dead, minus all the infighting, unless you want like your Ash character to be your Harry Cooper character.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's not like the racial tension, or even like you said, there's no class tension in between all of them. But still kind of the same thing, trapped in a house,
right.
Trying to get in, even though it's already in this one.
Yeah, there's a certain similarities, but always the diminishment of the horror effect is what you can expect with these type of movies when you go to the second film and the third film. And I suppose it's also inevitable that as you rewatch the first film over and over again, you're going to stop really being shocked by it because it becomes second nature. Alien and Blade Runner had such a tremendous effect on all the entertainment that we watch that it's easy to see why kids today must say, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
People are going, kids are going to bed with their alien toy, snuggling up to this. And I think they had another one that was even bigger, a toy that was Hasbro would put out.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And it made a bit of a fuss about it because people were saying, well, how can you sell something like that, to a child, But they did. And as soon as you start selling toys, it has to be, it's no longer really a scary monster.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the Tom Skerritt scene that I mentioned where he's crawling through the vents. They basically copied that on The Simpsons.
Oh, really?
Where the janitor is trying to get a dog out of the vents. That was the way they done it. It was pretty good. Kind of takes away from the tenseness of it.
Yeah, that's right. When you see all the parodies, it's kind of hard to go back to the original film and enjoy it the same way. But the some scenes that were almost duplicated in Aliens, like the scene where they come into the medical room after the facehugger has disappeared and they're looking around and the vents, that's sort of duplicated in Aliens, right? They have a similar scene where they're looking for the facehugger creatures and they're sort of creeping around in the medical room. It's been a while since I've seen Aliens. I don't remember the complete details, but the advantage was that James Cameron could improve the technology so that the creature could actually run along the floor rather than in the first film, it just sort of drops down limply onto Sigourney Weaver's shoulder because it's dead at that point.
Yeah.
But those sort of little embellishments, those sort of little improvements, I guess it's kind of hard to deny that that's a better way to do it. But the I guess what I think of is Ash's speech, and he says, "I admire its purity." That's the way I feel about this film.
Yeah,
it has a very simple and direct story, and the things that make it fascinating and the things that make it effective are the embellishments on that simple story. Right, the sets, the costumes, the characters, the monster, special effects, spaceship special effects. All of that is stuff that's been used in service of this very simple, very powerful story. And that's the perfect arrangement as far as I can see.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been looking at kind of doing some other research on other things. And I guess there's a book where a guy writes about how every movie is basically the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends on what makes it different is your characters and all this. You know, it's like there's only like five different stories that all the movies use. I can't remember exactly what all they were, but.
Is that Save the Cat book?
It may have been, yeah.
I assume Save the Cat is a reference to Alien, right?
It could be, I'm not for sure.
I forget what the theory was there, that if she had not saved the cat, she would have lost the audience.
Right.
That is illogical as it may seem for a character to do that in that situation. She had to do that because the audience wouldn't have forgiven her for leaving the cat behind. As a matter of fact, anytime you introduce an animal, a pet like that, the audience is very attentive to what happens to it. Yeah. If the filmmaker forgets about it, leaves it in a burning house or whatever, the audience doesn't like that, you know, which I can understand. I mean, in a way, the cat is similar to the other characters in that it just wants to go home. It just wants to go back to bed. You know, I mean, we can all sort of sympathize. This is a movie that starts with people waking and starts and ends with the survivor going to sleep.
Going to sleep, yeah.
And they are folks who are traveling home. They've had a long day, so to speak, and they just want to get home after their work. And they get detoured into this horrifying adventure that none of them really wanted to be a part of. In a way, that's helps to make the story even more effective, because if this was a story about a bunch of people that were going out in space to find aliens,
yeah,
we wouldn't feel the same way about it, right? It's the sadness of it. The you just think, oh, isn't that too bad? All these folks just want to get home, you know, and they have to go through all this shit. And the same is true of the cat. The cat is just like this. It just wants to go to sleep, right? It wants to find a little corner to curl up in. So the cat is important, I guess. It's the impractical thing that reveals the humanity of the characters, because the alien, as Ian Holm describes, is all about sort of pure survival instinct, just existing and reproducing.
Right.
Similar in that way to the shark and Jaws. So it's inhuman in the true sense, in that it doesn't have any interest in music or literature or anything like that. It's just a thing, a biological thing, almost like mold, that it exists just to exist. And the human beings are about, I think in one scene they have Dallas sitting in the shuttle listening to classical music or something.
Mm-hmm.
The human beings have their other interests, right? They have a conversation around the table where Yaphet Kotto talks about what he's looking forward to eating when he gets back.
Yeah.
Right? He's not talking about food. Those other sort of trivial or frivolous things that don't have anything to do with survival, it just have to do with pursuit of happiness. That's sort of symbolized by the presence of the cat. The cat doesn't serve any function. It's just to remind the crew and the audience that these are human beings. They have a pet, right, that they care about, even though it doesn't contribute anything.
Yeah.
And it's more trouble than it's worth, and they still care about it, right? That's something that you wouldn't expect from the alien, right? The xenomorph creature is not going to be worrying about whether or not his cat is taking care of it.
Yeah.
So it's important for that reason. It also brings in a little bit of color into the film, right? The
long
orange tabby. But I don't know if these are things where the people who wrote them said, oh, it has to be this way for, you know, this reason, or if it just wasn't done on a, gut level. Like they said, it feels like we need this.
Yeah.
And maybe that the best movies, that's not, you know, at least half of the decisions that are made, the artistic decisions, aren't made on the basis of somebody saying, oh, it has to be this way for a specific reason. It's just an intuitive thing. It feels right, you know. And then later you realize, oh, it's right because of
all of this. Yeah.
All this, yeah. So in answer to, I guess, your first question, I think Ridley Scott is very important. to the success of the film. Dan O'Bannon is, of course, important because he's the guy that came up with the idea. And other people like, I think his name is Terry Rawlins, the director, the editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very important to the effectiveness of the film because he cut it in a certain way. I know they had a lot of fuss about Jerry Goldsmith's score. He was unhappy with the way they edited the score and the way they mixed the score in with the sound effects and things. They tried to downplay his music a little bit and they replaced some parts of his music, and they actually asked him to rewrite the opening music, and he was kind of upset about that.
But I
have to say, in the end, I thought the music was very effective, very memorable. Oh, yeah. And the use of that little piece by some other composer, I'm not familiar with the composer, but they took a piece of music for the end titles and use that rather than Jerry Goldsmith's music. And Jerry Goldsmith, I guess, was a little upset by that. But I think it was ideal, because what you want at the end of a movie like this is to be able to exhale.
Yeah.
You need something that sounds a little sweeter. And the music almost sounds like, it feels like an exhale. Like, oh my God, we made it through. Yeah. And now we can relax.
Right? Well, he got paid either way, right? Why would he care?
He might have actually gotten paid more because they used some music from his score for Freud, which was a John Huston film that had been done several years earlier.
I don't know how royalties work whenever you're a composer. Like, does he get money every time it plays on TV, or is it just a lump sum at the beginning?
I guess different people get different arrangements, but he was pretty well established by that point. As a matter of fact, he was also working on the music for Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Right.
It came out the same year. So I think he probably would have been able to drive a pretty hard bargain and get a good deal for himself. But if he had done this music for Freud, and that was music that was being bought by Alien, by the production company, to use in the film, which they would have had to do. Fox produced Freud, I believe, but they still would have had to pay somebody.
Right. Yeah.
So I assume he would get some of that money if he was the composer of the music. I would hope so. I would think that any time, if you're a composer of his stature, any time the company that you wrote the music for is able to sell it for any other purpose other than just being in that movie, then you would have to get some sort of compensation. Yeah. So he probably got a little extra. But apparently it was a question of him not, maybe his pride being wounded. He didn't, apparently he had a hard time communicating with Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott had particular attitude about what he wanted in the music. And I guess they just had a disagreement about that. It doesn't sound like Jerry Goldsmith holds any hard feelings. He's right. In a documentary. But I don't think he worked with Ridley Scott after that, and he's passed away now. But nobody would ever say that he wasn't a genius. He was one of the great film scorers.
Oh, yeah.
But he just seemed to have some different ideas about how the music at the beginning of the movie should go. And Dan O'Bannon talks about how he bought the score, the soundtrack album, and there were certain pieces of music in it that he thought were very good. But when he thought about it, he couldn't see how, these were pieces that apparently didn't make it their way into the movie. He couldn't see how it could have been used in the film. As much as he liked the music, he couldn't see how it would work in the context of the finished film. So maybe that was really the problem, is that Jerry Goldsmith was trying to insert an attitude or a feel in the music that he was writing that wasn't really congruent with the effect that they were trying to go for in the movie. But some of his music is very effective even still, you know.
Yeah, him, John Williams, Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
Are they all the big ones? That's the one you think of.
John Barry, I guess his name is, the guy who wrote the scores for most of the Bond, early Bond films.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a lot of gorgeous scores. And I always remember, I think we might have talked about this recently, his score for Out of Africa, which was a film that I didn't really care for. But boy, I love the music. And I don't know if it necessarily made the movie better.
Right.
In a way, when you were watching the movie, you're thinking, gee, I wish this music was on a better movie.
Yeah.
So it isn't always a question. I know Jerry Goldsmith said in talking about Alien, he said, what you're always trying to achieve is music that will work with the film, but also can stand by itself.
Right, yeah.
I'm not sure I completely agree with him on that. It seems to me that the only real goal for a person scoring a film is to make music that works with the movie that it's in.
Yeah.
If it turns out to be music that also can be appreciated by itself, then that's an extra, that's a bonus. But I don't think that's something you should be thinking about while you're composing the music. But what the fuck am I?
No, yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard some scores that I can listen to. I'm a fan of, like, scores.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, you know, Batman 89, I can listen to that score without, you know, by itself, without the movie. I think it's a great.
Yes, except for the Prince songs. I love Prince.
I even like the stuff he done for it.
You've come to like them? Or yeah. Did you
I've liked them? Them. I've liked them ever since they came out.
Well, I have to admit, going through that time when that, I guess he wrote two songs for that.
I believe so, yeah.
And you couldn't get away from them on the radio around that time. So I guess even if I didn't like it to begin with, I had to come to like it eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of great scores. And I suppose you could say that Jerry Goldsmith's score for Star Trek, The Motion Picture, is the best thing about the movie. So in that sense, he did achieve his goal of making something which helped the movie that it was in. And also his music that had its own life. It could be appreciated by itself. So I guess it was possible to do that. At least for him, it was possible to do that. But the total package, the final film, as you say, it's just one of those instances where everything came together in the right way. And, you know, I think it's still an extraordinary movie.
If I was going to rate it, 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I would say I can't think of anything about it that I would really want to change. And I can't think of any other film that, certainly from that time, that manages to do what it does.
You know? Yeah, there's not one thing that I hate. There's not one thing I can set there. I can't even nitpick this movie. We do that all the time, but this one, it's a perfect movie, just about.
Right. Well, I think so many filmmakers approach movies, and maybe this is the way, the attitude they had to start with Alien, where you think, what's the least that we can do to get away with this? What's the least that we effort that we have to put into it in order to make it work, in order to be successful? And Ridley Scott took it to the next level. Right? He said, I'm not going to do the least. I'm going to do the maximum. I'm going to push this into a whole other league. You know, almost create a whole new subgenre of science fiction films. And so it really, you know, it's an exceptional thing. But so Mr. Scott is certainly, he certainly hit it out of the park on this one.
And I guess I hear he's doing a TV show, right?
I mean, to me, it's amazing to see how active he's been in the past few years.
Yeah.
He's not a young man anymore, obviously, that he's still turning out movies so frequently and big productions. That is very encouraging and inspiring. To those of us of a certain age, but I guess it's great he's making movies and making TV shows. I don't know if I have any particular interest in seeing more Alien stuff, and I would have thought that it's been like what he's done, been involved in like two Alien
two Conan. Yeah, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, yeah,
and I have them, and I sort of briefly looked at them, and it's nothing in them that really makes me say, oh, I must sit down and watch this.
Yeah.
It just looks like more stuff that's done almost entirely in CGI and heavily processed and, you know, in the computer, everything is, and everything has that sort of computery look that we expect from movies nowadays, especially science fiction.
I did see Prometheus in the theater.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
I was kind of excited for it. Because, you know, it's a new Alien movie by Ridley Scott. You think, okay, great. And, you know, I was a fan of the actress that's in it, Naomi Rapace, or however you pronounce her name. So I went and watched it. And it was kind of a letdown.
Yeah.
They, like I said, they tried to explain too much. The engineers and the jockey and wires, all this stuff here. It's just...
Well, did the audience, did you see it with a decent sized audience?
I don't remember how big of an audience it was.
I'm wondering how effective was it as a viewing experience? Was it anything like Alien?
Oh no, nothing.
See, that's the
compared to Alien, it was too bright. You know what I'm saying? Everything was well lit and it just didn't have the same feel. It was like a different movie. If he could have done it as a standalone movie somehow, I think it would have been better. I could have appreciated it more. But the fact that it was some kind of Alien prequel, sequel, I don't know. It just didn't work.
I think we said something similar to that about some other movie recently. I forget what the last film that we, what was the last film that we talked about? The last episode might have been, was it Hitchcock? No, it couldn't have been any Hitchcock. Anyway, sometimes you do feel like that when you see these sequels. You say, if they had detached it from that thing, then it might have been interesting by itself. But because we go in with certain expectations, and because
I think we were talking about the Twilight Zone remakes.
Oh, maybe so. Yes. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yes. The inability to sort of get the connection out of our minds while watching these things really hurts those sequels and remakes. And it might be better to say, we're not doing that. We're going to do something similar to that, but we're not going to do exactly that. It's not going to be a continuation of that story.
Yeah.
I mean, if Ridley Scott had the ability to do something like Alien and Blade Runner, why wouldn't he be able to get some of his writer friends together and pay them a little money to come up with some ideas so they can do something that would have the same power, but wouldn't just be a retread or
a rehash? Yeah.
You know, why is it so hard to do that? I don't understand. I mean, I know why it's hard for me to come up with a successful script.
Right.
I'm one person and I'm obviously limited by my talent. But if you have somebody who clearly is exceptionally talented and he has access to all the talents.
Oh, yeah, everybody. Everybody pitch in on this script.
It also amazes me that, like with the Star Trek and the Star Wars things, they're being run by some, you know, really powerful people. Disney is running the Star Wars universe. Yeah. And Paramount is running the Star Trek franchise. And you think to yourself, with all the resources they have, with all the brilliant people that they have access to, why are they still doing retreads of those things? Why can't they sit those people in a room and say, come up with something that will be as popular as Star Wars? You mean to say Star Wars was such a brilliant idea that nobody can come up with
that? That's it. That's all been come up with, yeah.
You just got to keep repeating the same thing? That doesn't make any sense to me. When Marvel was in its prime back in the 60s, when Stan Lee was throwing off these ideas and everything seemed to be a hit, the Hulk and the Thor and the Silver Surfer and the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and all the rest, there was no question that any idea that you came up with, you did it as well as you could, and it would become part of the canon and become part of the culture eventually. And now we're in a period where go back and try to find minor characters in the comics from years ago, rather than simply saying, why can't we do the same thing Stan Lee came?
Yeah.
We can't come up with a fucking superhero character that would be popular. Back then, everything he did was popular. Was he popular, such a unique genius? I don't think so. I mean, I'm not denying his importance in the history of comics, but is it possible that he was the only person that could
come up with characters?
Now, nothing. Nobody can come up with anything that has any impact on the culture at all. It all has to be old stuff, right? We do a series about Alfred, the butler, to the character, but you can't come up with.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. I'm a poor person, so I have to divide. I have to focus mostly in my life on just surviving. So I don't have much time to sit around trying to think up ideas. And I don't know who I would give them to, even if I came up with them. But these guys have all the resources and all the money, and they have no concerns about their own personal situation, right? They have enough money to last several lifetimes.
Yeah.
And yet they can't spend a couple of weeks trying to come up with a fresh idea.
Something new, yeah.
I don't understand. But anyway. What can you say?
So I guess you recommend people watch Alien if they've never seen it. I can't imagine no one's ever seen it, but at this point.
It is hard to imagine, yes.
I'm sure there's probably more people that are fans of Aliens and have never seen Alien.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Aliens definitely seems to be more crowd-pleasing, and there are a lot of what I consider to be rather limited intellects online saying that Alien is garbage and Aliens is a great film.
You can make a video game out of Aliens, not Alien.
That seems to be the important thing.
Yeah.
I love Aliens. I don't want to disparage.
Oh yeah, I think it's great.
Yes, but that's something where it just is meant to be a great ride, and obviously he had an enormous advantage because all the research and development had been done in Ridley Scott's movie. They had the design of the alien, the overall look of the film, and the overall look of the sets and the costumes, and the important character, Sigourney Weaver's character.
Yeah.
The whole premise had already been established by Ridley Scott and Dan O'Bannon in the first film. And it's always easier to improve on something that's pre-existing, somebody else's work. You can, you know, how many great editors there have been over the years. They can't write a damn on their own, but they can look at the work of a great writer and say, if you just change this, it's going to be better.
Yeah.
It's always easier to improve on the work of a great artist than it is to start from scratch. This is the problem I have with fan films. You know, making a film that looks just like Star Wars or just like Lord of the Rings, that isn't proof of anything.
No.
I mean, it might be proof of some technical stuff. You have the ability to make costumes a certain way or do makeup or optical effects. But it's the creative thing, the thing that people are really buying is the thinking stuff, the part that involves actually coming up with these ideas, coming up with the design for Darth Vader's helmet, not figuring out a way to make something that looks like Darth Vader's helmet using plastic bottles. You know, that shows a certain cleverness. But it's useless in Hollywood movie making because they don't need to use detergent bottles to make.
Yeah, when I first got After Effects, of course I made a lightsaber and After Effects, but I had to make a whole movie. I don't need all that. That's what kind of bugs me about, you know, like you said, fan films is it's fine if you're getting together with your friends on the weekend and going out in the woods and filming a lightsaber scene, but don't try to sell a movie that's a fan film. Don't ask me for money
for you
to make your fan film.
We can look back now. How many, has it been a couple of decades now that people have been doing these fan films? It feels like it's been like for the past 20 years or so.
Oh, yeah.
And how many of them have actually led to lasting, important careers in film? How many of the people start doing their own Batman movie end up actually working on Batman movies? It's perfectly fine. It's wonderful that people are enthusiastic about these things and they want to be a part of it. But the process of doing it, while you may learn a lot, unless you take that jump and say, now I have to start doing my own stuff.
Yeah.
You never really, I should say never, because who knows, tomorrow maybe somebody will become a big success. But it seems to me that you're in a much better place if you're coming up with ideas that you own, that you can exploit with full authority, rather than trying to put yourself in a position where you say, I represent the fans and the fans don't like how you're doing Star Trek now, so we're going to show you how it should be done. I mean, you're setting yourself up for failure because people are naturally going to scrutinize your work much more closely than something that's actually an official product, right?
Yeah.
They're constantly going to be looking at your thing and saying, see, it's an amateur. Yeah, it's an amateur doing this, not a professional. And there'll be so many signs of it. We were talking about the cast in Alien. I mean, that's the first big hurdle. How do you get people like that to work on your little fan film? So you end up instead with your sister and, you know, some friend of yours from college or whatever it is. And that's great, you know, but it's not going to work. As soon as people say, as soon as these actors say a single line of dialogue, the audience will go,
And plus, why make a Kickstarter and try to get everybody to give you money to make something that you can't turn around and make money on?
Right.
You can't make money on your Batman fan film. So come up with something that you can actually sell, make money on to make a better movie later.
I agree. Kickstarter, I guess, made it easier to do fan films because you could take away the whole question of how are you going to make the money back?
Yeah.
If we invest in this, how are we going to? Well, Kickstarter is donations. It's not an investment, so people can raise money. And apparently, some people are very successful at it. I know some filmmakers that have done five or six films. They're not fan films, really, but
right,
they've done five or six of the low budget films. I don't know if I would have the same success, but I'm just not that attractive a fellow, I guess. I'm just not popular in that way. But yeah, I think doing a fan film or two just to sort of give it a try and to experiment and to see what's possible, fine.
Don't make a career out of it.
At some point, you should recognize that all the people on the low budget level, on the high budget level, at some point they had to start coming up with something original and something that they was uniquely theirs, instead of continuing to just sort of imitate.
Yeah.
All the great films, even though you could say, well, it's inspired by this or influenced by that, there's a spark of originality and creativity that is absent by the very nature of fan films. They lack that sort of inspiration. They don't have the same level of creativity because it's not required. You're just borrowing ideas from somebody else.
Yeah. And if you could make a Batman costume, you could make up your own character. There's no, you know what I'm saying? It's not like I can only make a Batman costume. Well, no, you can't.
Yeah, and when you stop and think about it, Batman, which was influenced by a pulp character, the Black Bat, and also by a pulp character, the Shadow.
Yeah.
It's the easiest thing to do, to have that sort of nighttime Avenger creeping around on the rooftops. Why wouldn't you say, well, we like Batman, so we're going to do our version of it.
Come up
with something that we own and something where we could put our own twist on it, or make it more relevant to the time that we're living in, or make it more relevant to who we are, you know?
Yeah.
And yet, when you do see that, sometimes when people say, oh, I'm going to do my own thing, you end up with stuff that ends up on Red Letter Media's Best of the Worst.
Yeah.
I was watching an episode they did recently about the Black Cougar. Was that the name of the superhero movie? Low budget superhero movie?
I don't guess I've seen that one yet.
No. It was very amusing. wasn't very good. The film didn't really work out. So I guess that's the other thing, that when you do a fan film, because all the creative work has been done for you, all the brain work has been done for you, you don't risk falling that far. If you're left to your own devices, if you actually have to come up with characters and a premise, then you risk revealing that you don't have any ability to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe for some folks, doing fan films is about all they can hope for. I suppose it's possible that some of the people that do fan films, like Star Trek fan films, they may have moved up to doing the TV series, you know, working on the TV shows. I don't know. I haven't kept track of all of that, obviously, but I suppose it's conceivable. If you do special effects and miniature stuff or CGI, that maybe you might get the call from the big studios to come on and help them with their stuff. I suppose they're always looking for people to do that sort of stuff, right? They need skilled people. But as far as actually making a film, you know, being the director or the writer, you know, it requires a lot of effort, and it requires skills that some people, you know, a genius that some people don't have. Many people don't, most people don't have, I should
say. So where can everybody find your fan films at?
Well, Demon Resurrection is on Tubi right now, and it's on Amazon Prime as a pay-per-view title, and it's on Zumo TV. And Sleepless Nights, we're waiting, I assume, in the next couple of weeks, it'll finally end up on Amazon. I don't know if it's going to be a pay-per-view or if it's going
now,
do they
tell you first, like, hey, next week your movie's going to be on, or is it just going to show
don't.
Up and you're going
no,
to be surprised?
Just shows up, yeah. we're putting that, that's a 25-year-old movie. I'm talking about Sleepless Nights.
Yeah.
And I recently re-edited it and up-resed it to high definition and did a lot
of
work.
And I've seen it, and it's really good.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yes, I'm hoping that that will be the consensus. But there's no money behind it. This reissue of the film is really just something I did for the heck of it, just because I want to see the film out there. So we put it, gave it to Film Hub. I don't know if you've heard of Film Hub. That's I guess you could call it an aggregator. It's a company that you can reach the streaming platforms through.
Almost like a distributor.
It is, yeah. They take a percentage, but the idea is that any film, anything that's presentable as a film, you can upload it to them, and they'll offer it to all the streaming platforms that are out there. And some of the streaming platforms are curated, so they're very selective about the type of movie. So your movie might not be able to get on those, but there are a lot of others that are a little more open. They're pretty much willing to take anything that's presentable film. Right. And so there's an opportunity there that you wouldn't have if you were trying to go by yourself to, say, Apple TV.
Apple or Netflix, TV, yeah. You know?
So if, with Demon Resurrection, initially Film Hub wasn't really doing that much for us, but they sort of, the company has been, Film Hub has been reconfigured over the past few years, and they have an approach now that is, seems to be more effective in getting films out there. So with Demon Resurrection, as soon as I got it on Tubi TV, we probably made more money and got more attention for the film than we had in the previous 5 years. So it's a good way to do business, and it's not exclusive. So you don't have to worry about losing control of your film. So Sleepless Nights, my second film, Demon Resurrection is already up on Tubi and Amazon Prime, but Sleepless Nights hopefully will start appearing on those platforms in the next couple of weeks or next couple of months, however long it takes. But it's up there on Film Hub now, and they're offering it to the world. So if you're, we have streaming people that work for streaming platforms out there that are looking for, a vampire story, look for Sleepless Nights.
Sleepless Nights, there you go.
It's on Film Hub, so that's what I'm doing. And you can, people who are interested in any of this stuff, they can find me on Facebook and Twitter. And my films, Demon Resurrection and Sleepless Nights, have Facebook and Twitter pages as well. And we have, I have a YouTube channel where this video and many of our other episodes, the video versions of our episodes, the discussions that we've had of other films are up on that channel. I know you're doing some of the stuff on your channel as well now, putting some of the...
trying to add more stuff. It's hard for me on my old computer to edit longer videos. I've been trying to do the shorter videos, but it seems they seem to be pretty popular. Well, 5 minute video on YouTube seems to be doing pretty good.
Well, I struggle with my equipment as well because it's so old. The computer, the Mac that I use to do my editing, is like 15 years old. So I know how you feel. But I have the Phantasm episode that we did a while back. That's almost finished. So that'll probably be coming out shortly. And then I'm going to start doing the rest and get them all knocked off. So, but Alien, I would say people should seek out. And if they do seek it out, try to find the theatrical version, the original theatrical version without the additional scenes, and try to watch
it. Was that included? That was included on the DVD, right?
On the DVD set that I had from years ago, they call it the Alien Legacy edition. They had the theatrical version on one disc, and they had deleted scenes as a separate feature on that disc.
Okay.
So I know that some of the ones they have now, like have a Blu-ray version where apparently, and I think it's been out for a while, you can shift between versions. In other words, if you want to watch, you can sort of program it so that it'll what do they call that? Not linking or streaming. What do they call it when you can shift between different channels on a Blu-ray or a DVD? Anyway, you can do that.
You can watch either the theatrical or the director's cut.
And you can decide which your deleted scenes you want to see. Right? So I would say probably that's not a good idea.
Say,
get
just
a Blu-ray.
Stick with the theatrical,
If you can get a Blu-ray version of the theatrical version, that's probably the best thing. Because you're seeing it in keeping with Ash's statement about admiring purity. You're seeing the pure thing the way it originally appeared with none of the extra unnecessary bells and whistles that were added on.
Right.
The only thing I would say is a possible negative about the DVD set that I bought is that the audio is not quite as robust as I hoped it would be.
Yeah.
I'm not a real audiophile, but I remember seeing the movie in the theaters, and I remember being very impressed by the mix, the audio mix, the sound effects and the score and all the rest. And I didn't really get that on the DVD, but possibly on the Blu-ray.
Fixed that.
So that's the last word on Alien, I guess. Definitely a must watch if you haven't seen it.
All right. Well, this was a good episode. Can't wait to see what we're going to talk about doing next. And until next week, we will continue to watch The Good, the Bad, and the Cheaply Made.